Welcome to a very special edition of Unk Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Unk Live On Air is a podcast from Unk Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Unk Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Today, we had the pleasure of speaking with Everett Vokes, MD, John E. Altman Professor, Physician-in-Chief, and Chair of the Department of Medicine at the University of Chicago Medicine. Dr. Vokes is an internationally renowned expert in head and neck cancer, having pioneered combination chemotherapy and radiation as a first-line treatment for patients. Dr. Vokes is also the recipient of the new Translational Research Professorship from the American Society of Clinical Oncology, as well as the Francis L. Lederer Foundation grant for research on the malignancies of the upper aerodigestive tract. In 2013, Dr. Vokes was recognized as the OncLive Giant of Cancer Care for head and neck cancer for his tremendous achievements. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Vokes discussed the path that led him to specialize in head and neck cancer and lung cancer, personal and professional challenges he encountered along the way, and the ultimate importance of bringing multimodality therapy to the forefront of treatment.
Thank you so much for joining me on a very special episode of OncLive On Air. So to start, I guess I wanted to ask you, why did you want to specialize in oncology, and what path led you to the field of head and neck cancer specifically?
Well, oncology itself as a choice was not something I was about to do, you know, say my whole life. It is something that came to me slowly and in steps. And I think the first one was a rotation as a medical student. I was living in Germany at the time, but had a rotation in Australia where patients were treated already with chemotherapy, more so than what I was able to observe at the time in West Germany. And so this was a hospital in Sydney, and there were patients with Hodgkin's lymphoma that were getting, you know, early forms of CHOP chemotherapy and seemed to be doing well. So there were some patients in active treatment and some people that were coming for follow-up. And of course, the larger concepts and the history of this was not something I understood at the time, but it became clear that rather than thinking about malignancy as something that is local and treated with surgery, and for Hodgkin's, of course, this was already established, one should think about it as a systemic disease. And so the next step, of course, is training and internship and residency and eventually moving to the United States, back to the United States, and being exposed to head and neck cancer patients during my fellowship training. Now, the interesting thing there was that, like in lymphoma, we could give chemotherapy, particularly if patients were previously untreated and were getting it as neoadjuvant, which was a brand new thing. And you saw very rapid shrinkage of tumors. So in that sense, it appeared to be similar to Hodgkin's disease. The crucial difference, of course, was that the cure rates were much lower, particularly if patients got chemotherapy first and then surgery, and sometimes radiation after, and sometimes just radiation instead of the surgery. But the recurrence rates were high. And so you had a similarity in that tumors were responsive, but what was very different is that they were not cured with chemotherapy alone. And what was needed was a good organization of multi-specialty therapy. And that's really what I think the focus of my career ended up being, that we were looking at better ways to integrate systemic therapy into combined modality curative intent therapy. And the goals, of course, are in curative intent therapy to cure, but the second very important goal in head and neck cancer was organ preservation, so to try and limit surgery or avoid it altogether, not because surgery is bad intrinsically, but that if other modalities allow the patients to be more functional, particularly if they are cured and live a long time, then those should be the options we look at first. And that really is what has been achieved to a significant, if not complete, degree in head and neck cancer treatment. So larynx preservation is standard. Here at the University of Chicago, we can treat many oral cancers, tongue cancers, with organ preservation intent. So we don't always do surgery first. We do it last, as a last resort, if it has to be done. Is also an option for some other head and neck cancers where surgery is very hard to do, such as nasopharynx cancer and some other oropharyngeal tumors. So that is how I ended up being a head and neck cancer investigator, but focusing on interactions with other specialties and the tight coordination of multi-specialty care.
So would you say that passion to kind of bring more multidisciplinary care to patients with head and neck cancer is true of your patients with thoracic malignancies as well?
Thoracic malignancies have a similar group of what we refer to as intermediate stage patients. So in head and neck cancer, what is unique is that a majority of patients present with local regionally advanced disease. So lymph node involvement and advanced T stage, although the total tumor burden is less than it is in some other tumors. Curative intent therapy was requiring combined modality therapy was something that we had to define for a large percentage of patients. In thoracic malignancies, lung cancer, you've got an early group that is readily treated with surgery. We now know that a good number of them should also get adjuvant chemotherapy. And at the other end, 50% or so of patients present with metastatic disease, where we are now starting to think about maybe we can cure some of them. But for most of my career, we've looked at those patients as a group of patients that would be treated with palliative intent to prolong survival. But then, yes, in the middle here, too, we have a group of patients with advanced stage disease, but it's not metastatic outside of the chest or to the other side of the chest. And combined modality therapy can be applied. And yes, in many ways, we did similar studies there at the University of Chicago, but also at the national level and international level at times to look at ways to increase cure rates there.
Now, if you can recall going back to your residency, all throughout your practice, up to where you are today, is there a particular patient that completely changed your practice or has had a lasting impact on you?
I can't say that it's, you know, the single impactful patient as such. You of course, remember some terrible failures, maybe more so than the successes. But there have been patients with advanced tongue cancer where chemoradiotherapy is given and it's a few years later and the patient is alive and functional. You don't know that when the patient completes treatment, but at some time later on, you realize this patient has done really, really well. And that, of course, has lasting impact, but it's not immediate because success is not immediate. Failure can be immediate and that you will know. So a person where treatment does not work, you know that right away. Or a patient who has horrible side effects, you know that right away. And in many ways, those are cases we learn from just as much.
Now, through those successes and failures, is there a particular motto that you've stuck to throughout your practice?
Well, the practice is to take care of patients, to individualize care. And these days we think about that in terms of the drugs that we use. I think for most of my career, we've also thought about that as how we talk and interact with the patient and try to understand the patient's world where the patient lives in. So attention to a patient and their individual needs, I think, is something that I try to teach and also practice myself. Other mottos apply a little bit more to my administrative functions, and they have to do, again, with how we interact with people and, you know, fairness and transparency are really the guidelines for me in that respect.
What would you say has been your proudest moment?
Well, proudest moment, it's not moments. You look more back over longer periods of time and you see there is significant success and many patients that have done well over the years, many trainees that have done well that I have mentored or participated in their education in some form. There are, of course, professional achievements, becoming a tenured professor at the University of Chicago, or now elected to be president-elect of ASCO. Those are, you know, achievements that I'm very proud of. They don't individually define the proudest moment. Those are probably personal and family events. So, you know, that rate higher, the birth of a child or getting married and similar events in personal life.
And many of those achievements, of course, led to your nomination as a Giant of Cancer Care nominee for Head and Neck, which you then went on to win. So what does it mean to receive that award that is nominated by your peers?
I think it's a tremendous honor to be awarded that. You know, you look at this with some modesty and you say, why me? But then again, you don't want to question that too hard because it feels pretty good. And so I was very proud of that.
Now, what challenges have you faced in your career and then the hurdles that you overcame?
I think any physician, academic physician in particular, maybe faces the hurdles that come with a career in an academic setting, the pressures early on, the reputational establishment that has to be done of a career. For me in particular, maybe the addition that I did grow up in Germany, so I had to get used to the American system to some degree, although I spoke English and didn't have a too big hurdle there. As an oncologist, the broad spectrum of knowledge that is required, it's internal medicine, it is pharmacology, it's new drugs that go deep into basic biology. And of course, you want to try and keep up with all of that and be educated and understand what you do or what you should do. And so I think that's an ongoing hurdle for all of us in oncology to stay up to date and to know our field as big and broad as it is.
Now, when it comes to research, you've of course been a part of many studies. So what research have you been a part of that have had significant impacts on practice? And what was it like to be a part of that?
In combined modality therapy, we have worked out relative benefits of adjuvant, neoadjuvant, and concurrent approaches. And to help to define that over many years and the relative strengths and weaknesses of those approaches has been very rewarding. So neoadjuvant chemotherapy, which was very attractive to me early on, allows us to assess in an individual patient the effects of chemotherapy. Is tumor shrinking or not? Ideally, we can get biopsies before and after. That's very hard to do. And then rationally analyze those for biomarkers or, you know, other markers of therapeutic efficacy. Adjuvant therapy is something that is very long. It takes a long time to evaluate and requires long follow-up, but there are certainly places where that should be studied. And then the power of concurrent chemoradiotherapy, which not only gives the systemic activity of the chemotherapy, but also the local and regional radiation enhancement, which leads to better local control, and a lot of patients do fail locally. So I think that has been really exciting and challenging to be a part of. We've also, in my time, have had several revolutions in the drugs that were available to us. So supportive care is maybe where it all started, better antiemetic therapies. The next improvement in the 90s in the types of chemotherapy that we have available and still use, taxanes, some of the anti-metabolites, gemcitabine. pemetrexed came a little bit later. And then the targeted therapies. So for the first time, we're truly understanding the more specific intervention that is, to some degree at least, individualized. And then currently, of course, immunotherapies. So there's a whole journey of discovery that in oncology we've been privileged to be a part of.
Is there a particular case that really stuck with you, maybe even a life-changing case, whether it was in terms of seeing the effects of neoadjuvant therapy for the first time or seeing a patient respond really well to immunotherapy?
Yes, there is. So the, you know, not life-changing, but maybe for the patient life-changing. The recent discovery, that's not unique to us, but you know, that I and certainly others have made. So you can give a patient with systemic disease, metastatic disease, immunotherapy systemically, and the patient can tolerate that for 2 years, say. That was unprecedented. With chemotherapy, we couldn't do that. And not only did the patient tolerate it for 2 years, but if you then stop treatment, in many patients, the tumor for long periods of time, maybe for the rest of their life, in some, does not grow back. And so I think that is truly profound and a recent observation. Targeted therapies, the big impact of EGFR targeted therapies initially in some patients where we didn't understand why until the description in 2004 or 2005 of the EGFR mutations, very impactful. And then early on, yes, neoadjuvant chemotherapies. So patients going to surgery and having complete response, so no tumor there, which, you know, may be the beginning of our ultimate goal of not only avoiding surgery, but truly decreasing the long-term toxicities of all treatment.
So now looking to the future, what other areas in oncology would you like to see flourish in the next couple of years?
I would like to see us finding better ways to give treatments. So do patients really have to come to the office quite as frequently? It's one thing if it's to systemically administer therapy. For follow-up visits, scans, and other things, I think we need to find better ways to truly work more remotely with patients. So this goes into telemedicine that we need to figure out better how we can simplify patients' lives and their interactions with us as physicians, but at the same time, of course, allowing us in the medical world to continue to be financially viable. So I think that that needs to be worked out on a larger level, and maybe ASCO and other organizations can help with that. There's never enough in terms of new therapies. I think cellular therapies are very, very exciting right now. Artificial intelligence, remote reading of pathology, and similar, maybe radiology. Those are, I think, exciting developments that I look forward to watching and maybe participating in as we move forward.
And as a mentor to many, is there a particular piece of advice that you've given that you've seen kind of really well adopted and taken to heart and then later led to some success?
This is very individual. I think that a trainee, you know, at some level, everybody's going to be smart, although some people can be really, really smart. And so what then, in addition to that, is required is energy and passion. And more than anything, a very good mentor or mentoring team. And I think the team is preferred so that the interactions can be broader and the input and the feedback can be broader. But I think passion for what one does is irreplaceable as not only a motivating factor, but also one that helps somebody get through the inevitable setbacks and more difficult times.
Is there anything else that you would like to highlight on the episode?
Well, I would still say that oncology in the 30 or so years that I've been in this field now, that it's been rewarding and exciting all along, but the progress that we've made, that is now, I think, starting to show in truly improved survival rates, including lung cancer and metastatic disease through immunotherapy, is very, very exciting. It's a terrific field to be in. I'm proud to be in this field, and I recommend it highly to our young trainees and residents.
Well, thank you so much for joining me on today's episode.
You're very welcome. It's been my pleasure.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to Onc Live On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for recaps from our State of the Science summits and exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.